Thank you. la pluie m'a réveillé. Ne me dis rien, il faut se taire. Les mots d'amour gelent l'hiver. Il n'y a rien à dire, il n'y a rien à comprendre. On vient la lumière de septembre, il faut s'aimer.
Ending this edition of Business Daily.
BBC, BBC.
Hello and welcome to Witness with me, Dina Newman. Today we're going back to Estonia, 3 years after this small Baltic country was taken over by the Soviet Union as part of the international settlement after World War II. In March 1949, tens of thousands of Estonians were suddenly rounded up and deported to Siberia.
Elagu Eesti Sotsialistlik Nõukogude Vabariik!
It's 1949 and Moscow is establishing a communist regime in Estonia. Russian propaganda films of the time show Estonians cheering to communist and Stalinist slogans. Tallinn Spring is a propaganda film showing the Estonian capital at its best, with the sun reflecting in the waves of the Baltic Sea, pretty women buying spring flowers, and happy children going to school. Yet that same spring, in March 1949, the Soviet authorities launched a secret deportation campaign, sending tens of thousands of Estonians to eastern Siberia.
On the 25th of March 1949, we were at home on our own. We heard the doorbell and then the voice, "Open the door, it's passport control." We opened the door and five men came in. Three of them were Russian soldiers with guns.
Rita and her twin sister Tia were 14, and their younger sister Una just 6. It was a school holiday, and their mother had gone to the countryside to get some food for the family.
We explained that our mum was away. "Who is the head of your family?" they asked. Tia, my twin, who was 15 minutes older than me, said she was in charge. Then they read out our deportation order. As the family of a nationalist, we were to be sent immediately to eastern Siberia.
The nationalist was the girl's father, Jan Aire, who had worked in a tax office during the German occupation of Estonia and had been conscripted into the German army in 1944. He had never fought for the Nazis on the front line, but when the Soviets took over, they sentenced Jan Aire to 5 years in labor camps as a Nazi collaborator. A year later, they came to take the rest of the family.
We asked for permission to call our mum, because there was a phone line in the house where she was staying, but they didn't allow us to make the phone call. The two Estonians in the deportation team wondered aloud if they should leave us, children, in peace. But the Russian soldiers said, "No, we have a plan. We can't miss our targets, so let's take the girls."
The operation was conducted on a secret order from the Kremlin.
The Council of Ministers has ordered a deportation from the Latvian, Lithuanian and Estonian Soviet republics of rich farmers and their families of armed bandits and nationalists, and families of convicted nationalist collaborators.
Labeled as socially alien elements, all these categories were targeted because Moscow feared that they might sabotage communist rule. At the same time, the deportees were expected to provide cheap labor, crucial to the Soviet Union's post-war recovery. Three Estonian girls were hardly a productive labor force, but the deportation targets set before the Soviet army were tough, and the soldiers were in a hurry. The Irish sisters were given just 1.5 hours to pack.
Strangely, we didn't panic. We collected whatever we could. When we were ready, Tia and I asked for permission to sing a song before we leave.
In Estonia, just about every occasion is marked with a song. The soldiers did not have the heart to refuse the girl's request.
Tia was a good singer, and I was learning the piano. So I played, and she sang "Come Back to Sorrento" in Estonian. This was the only time when we cried. Our little sister, of course, was in tears the whole time, but we only cried once.
The Irish sisters were driven to the railway station and loaded onto a cargo train with their belongings.
Everyone's luggage was on the floor, and people slept on their bags and suitcases. There was no toilet, just a bucket. But in between the daily stops, there wasn't anywhere to empty the bucket, and the stench was terrible.
Their journey to the Krasnoyarsk region in eastern Siberia lasted 2 weeks, enough time for Rita, Tia and Una to adjust to their orphan status. The girls assumed that they'd lost their mother for good, just like a year earlier they had lost contact with their father.
Tia and I used to talk and to make plans, how we would survive, go to work and support our little sister. We were tough, you see. We were children of war, not like young people today. Our little sister used to play with the other children in the carriage, and everyone used to sing our Estonian songs. One of our favorites was called I Want to Go Home.
On the 10th day of their journey, when the train was near its final destination, a miracle happened.
We were sitting in our carriage, and suddenly we hear someone calling our names. I can't talk. I'm sorry. We opened the door, and at first we did not recognize our mum. Her hair had gone all white, and she looked so old.
On the day of their deportation, Rita's mother had got home and learned that her daughters had been put on the train bound for Siberia. She got to the railway station just in time to squeeze into the last truck of the train full of deportees. For 10 days, whenever the train stopped, she would walk along the platform asking everyone if they'd seen the girls. She had gone through 10 trucks before she found them.
The whole carriage was looking at us, and everyone was in tears. It was such a joy. You see, throughout that journey, we had had nothing but sadness. One woman had given birth in our carriage, and the baby died, and they threw the body out, just like that. And here was a mother reunited with her children.
Once they reached Siberia, the family were sent to work, first on a collective farm, then felling wood, and later in a gold mine. Eventually, their mother was able to support the family on her own, and the girls had an opportunity to go to a local school. Rita met deportees from all over the USSR and realized it wasn't just Estonians who had been targeted. Yet, at her Russian school, Rita saw nothing but devotion to the communist cause.
In 1953, when Stalin died, I was at school, and all the teachers and all the students cried, except us. Why on earth did they cry? What moved them? Even today, I cannot comprehend the Russians' love for their tyrants.
After Stalin's death, Rita and her family were allowed to go back to Estonia. Their father had served his time, and the family was reunited. Rita Metsis now lives in Tallinn. Every year they have a reunion of her fellow deportees, and Rita has compiled a book of their memoirs. She spoke to me, Tina Newman, for Witness.
Thank you. I was obviously really inspired by punk.
Yeah.
70s punk and no wave and all these sort of iconoclast white culture movements.
Sure.
But also at the same time, I was really into 60s black free jazz.
Right.
And I related to that a lot. To me, that was sort of the punk of the black experience.
Sure.
For its time or what have you.
A lot of it was pretty DIY.
Yes. So. Yeah, and it was definitely iconoclastic musically.
Yeah.
More so than punk. But I think I was really encouraged by the attitudes of these people to be iconoclastic, and I didn't really see the cause and effect for a long time about how your actions and shit-talking and criticizing
right.
and picking on people necessarily wasn't going to be a thing that would be worshipped or appreciated.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I mean, I definitely was coming from a sort of nonconformist rebel fuck you punk attitude, but I also really did believe in free music, and I thought it was... I never felt like a dilettante in terms of free music. I always felt like it was an equal influence to me, and I really related to it. When I was in high school, I did a lot of reading about the Black Power movement.
Yeah.
And I was really impressed by it. I always thought it was a really powerful thing in terms of humanity, and I associated free jazz with that movement, and although I was coming from white Midwestern background...
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't really in a segregated situation. Rockford is a very busted out industrial large town.
Yeah.
And I was bused to kind of a desegregation project program, okay. like a school program. So huh. I tended to see people more individually than I was really worried about totally identifying with white culture
right.
or black culture for that matter or anything. So I'm not saying I don't have... I'm free of any prejudice or anything like that. But I think I was part of a social experiment that wasn't so segregated. So my influences are pretty heady mixture. But I was always into dissonance, and I was always into modernism. Like 20th century modernism to me is still the crusade.
The arch, more arch the better.
Yeah. So I don't know. When the Ludenmagers started, I wanted to play free jazz. But then as time went on, I felt like I should be writing because I had aesthetic things I wanted to accomplish in terms
right.
of harmony and structure and stuff like that. And I also think that Hal wasn't really that interested in playing my charts.
Right.
But Ken Vandermark was totally game. He came in and hacked away at my charts. Ken was in the band for about 2 years.
Uh-huh.
Between 1992 and 1994. And we had moments of getting along and kind of palling around, but I don't think we really saw eye to eye on a lot of things.
Well, he's also a very reserved kind of guy from my social experience.
Well, I think Ken Vandermark has been very calculated in terms of his career. He had things that he wanted to accomplish, and he had the social skills I didn't have to accomplish them. I mean, I really burnt a lot of things down in Chicago just because I thought I had to have an opinion and everyone had to know it. Mm-hmm. So Ken and I... ultimately, we were kind of stuck together because we didn't really have anyone else in our age
right.
bracket to play with. But then he got a gig playing with the NRG Ensemble, and they were going to go to the
right.
MERS Festival, and then Ken got kicked out and replaced with Mars Williams, who had sort of come back into the fold.
Right.
And I believe Ken was really disappointed about that, and that was a big blow to him because he thought he was on the cusp of something, and then he
right.
kind of got kicked out of the NRG Ensemble, and I think he was, when we met, he was kind of thinking about going back to Boston because things weren't going really well. But then he started the Vandermark Quartet, and he sort of made a lot of alliances with people like John Corbett.
Yeah.
And things were moving up for him. Meanwhile, we weren't really seeing eye to eye aesthetically because my shit was a little more raw, and obviously I was a loose cannon. Politically, I wasn't really playing it safe, so I think he had a lot of things going on, and he thought it would be probably a good idea to get away from me pronto. I took it a little personally as competition, so I wasn't really that nice about it, and I saw...
Well, he's doing a totally different thing, ultimately, so, I mean, it's like, whatever.
But back in the day, me as like a 20, 21-year-old, I was a little jealous because I thought that all of a sudden he was getting all this attention, and that I was doing the real shit
right.
and all this stuff, and it was just... it was just competitive bullshit. Now, you know, as a 46-year-old man, I just see that we're just doing different things.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of differences, and good for him. Yeah. He's done very well for himself, obviously. But I've also done well for myself, considering that what I do is never been too accessible on a bunch of levels. So
it's not accessible, but I don't. I might have, you know, even said this to you before, and I think he got a little ticked off. I find some of it, some of the late, like, not this Luttenbacher's, but sort of the later editions of previous Luttenbacher's, and even some of the really hardcore free jazz stuff that went in between, I actually find it, a lot of it, eminently listenable. You know?
Yeah,
I know, I don't find it off-putting or anything.
I always tried to approach whatever we were doing from a real rock and roll gut visceral thing.
Right.
I mean, I grew up listening to FM radio classic rock.
And rock and roll, Rockford,
Illinois.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what was on the radio was what you expect. You know, AC/DC, Foreigner, Journey, Boston.
Right.
Blah, blah, blah. Kiss. You know, I grew up listening to Kiss records. Kiss was sort of pre-punk for me. Kiss was punk rock about blowjobs.
Right.
And they don't really stand up as well. I mean, I still like Kiss a little bit, but they don't really stand up as well as other things. But it was a gateway drug. I come from a FM radio rock and roll background. So in a weird way, everything always had to have that visceral thrust to it. Even when I was doing very avant-garde music, I always wanted it to have that kind of balls.
Yeah.
Power. Well, thanks for noticing. I'm okay with that.
Okay.
Good. I mean, in a weird way, I didn't, when I was doing free music, I saw a lot of boring free music, and I didn't want to play boring free music.
Right.
Obviously, the things that really influenced me when I was 15, 16, 17 years old were hardcore 60s free jazz, like Cecil Taylor, Albert Eiler, Ornette Coleman, late Coltrane, to a lesser degree, the European stuff, because in the late 80s, there wasn't that much access to that stuff.
Right. I mean, other than like the Cadence North Country catalog, but even that was kind of
risky.
And they didn't have it. Well, yeah, you might not receive what you paid for, but.
Yeah. You know, Last Exit album was really important to me in high school.
Yeah.
For example, Peter Brotzman, obviously, who was really. He finally got popularized in America due to Ken Vanemark's efforts, I believe.
Yeah.
And John Corbett's efforts.
Right.
So,
that's where that MacArthur money mostly went.
Yeah.
So.
He, you know, Brotzman was a very seminal figure in the 80s. He wasn't really the giant of the music that he's seen as now. In high school, I was ordering a lot of stuff from the New Music Distribution Service, NMDS, which was founded by Michael Mantler and Carla Bley to distribute. I know you know this, but, you know, they were founded to distribute independent music, mostly not punk, you know, not DIY in the punk way, but DIY in the experimental music way.
Right.
And I got the catalog in 86 or 87, and it blew my mind.
Yeah, I would love to have seen an original catalog. I mean,
I
definitely have records with a sticker on it, you know. But
the reason why I started ordering from NMDS was that I was desperately looking for the DNA EP, Taste of DNA.
Yep.
And I couldn't find it. I couldn't order it. And I finally saw in a Spin magazine article about Kip Hanrahan that they had the address to the label in care of NMDS. So I wrote and I said, I'm trying to find this DNA record. And they said, well, we have it. And they sent this 86 catalog with Keith Haring on the cover, which is just like a who's who of independent experimental music.
Yeah.
And my mind was just blown.
Right.
That's how I found out about Borbito Magus, the Nihilist Spasm Band. I could go on forever and ever.
Yeah.
And I started taking chances, but I almost never got what I ordered. I tried to order the Faust record 3 or 4 times. It was never in stock, you know. But I didn't know anything about it. I just read about it, and it looked cool, and it sounded like it was cool, and I took a lot of chances. So in high school, I had already kind of, like, formulated my whole aesthetic.
Right.
Except for death metal.
That came later. Yeah,
that came later.
Déjà, je ne suis plus Tu m'admirais hier et je serai poussière pour toujours demain. On est bien peu de choses et mon amie la rose est morte ce matin. La lune cette nuit a veillé mon amie. Moi en rêve j'ai vu éblouissante et nue son âme qui dansait bien au-delà des nues et qui me souriait. Crois celui qui peut croire, moi j'ai besoin d'espoir, sinon je ne suis rien, ou bien si peu de choses. C'est mon ami la rose qui l'a dit hier matin.
Beursplein. Daar is een demonstratie van de Road to Gaza. Van die club die allemaal tochten naar Gaza organiseert. Noodzakelijke hulpgoederen daar krijgen. Dat wordt inmiddels van alle kanten geprobeerd. Terwijl er eigenlijk een hele simpele manier is natuurlijk. Maar stoppen met moorden. Maar als je in de Zuidoost bent, kan je ook naar het Anton de Komplein. Want daar is ook een demonstratie van heel veel Zuidoostclubben of zo. En dat gaat erover dat geen mens illegaal is. Dus als je in de Zuidoost bent, ga lekker naar het Anton de Komplein. Ben je wat meer in het oosten, dan kun je in Amersfoort, as we speak, kun je XR een handje gaan helpen. Want die zijn een distributiecentrum aan het blokkeren van Havi. Dat is een bedrijf dat globaal hand- en spamdiensten leeft aan de genocide supporter McDonald's. Die gewoon gratis hamburgers naar de delen aan de toegenaars. En daar, daar zitten ze al de hele dag, geloof ik. Toen ik van huis ging, zaten ze nog steeds. En die hebben zo'n distributiecentrum geblokkeerd. Dus het is een hele succesvolle actie met beelden te zien ook op XR TV. Als je toch thuis op de bank zit.